I'm Carl Lengel, and on today's Louisiana Considered, Putumayo Records continues to bring exciting new music, books, and explorations of global cultures. Dan Storper, Putumayo's founder, will join us to talk about the company built on sharing culture. Up first, too many Louisianans with disabilities live below the poverty level. Sarah Berthelot, president and CEO of the Louisiana Association of United Ways, joins us today to talk about some perspective on the effects of the pandemic on the disabled, and she'll explain how a new assessment might be helpful to a better future. Sarah, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the recent study. 60% of Louisianans with disabilities living below the federal poverty line. That's a staggering number. I was shocked. How did you conduct this research, and how did the results compare to maybe what you were expecting to find?
United Ways throughout Louisiana have worked in partnership with Entergy to participate in a national ALICE project called United for ALICE, which enables us to collaborate to bring very important research about the financial stability and vitality of the people of Louisiana. At the 32nd anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act, we're so pleased to bring this very special issue briefing focused on people with disabilities to our communities so that we can have a deeper understanding about the challenges people with disabilities face. The big takeaway from this report is while we have been able to understand using the traditional measure of the federal poverty threshold, about 24% of Louisiana's people with disabilities do live in poverty. This report illuminates that another 35% of people with disabilities struggle to make ends meet and are unable to earn enough to clear a very basic survival budget. And it tells us that 60% or more than 426,000 Louisiana people with disabilities have to make hard choices each day, and in some cases forego basic needs as a result of their limited budget.
Now, was this a surprise? Were there historic markers from before, or was this completely a surprise to you?
I think we've known for quite some time, we've all known that people with disabilities find it harder to secure a job than those without a disability. It could be a barrier of educational attainment or accessibility. The report confirms statistically just how different employment success or attainment is for people with disabilities versus those without. And people with disabilities make up 7% of our workforce. And despite having a master's degree or a bachelor's degree, people with disabilities, a good number of these workers still earn a wage that falls below the ALICE threshold. That was quite a surprise to put our arms around those figures. But here's something that was most surprising. There are more people with disabilities living under the ALICE threshold in Louisiana than any other state, with the exception of the District of Columbia. And so with 60% of our people with disabilities unable to earn a budget to meet their basic needs, that places us at a very high ratio. And the national average for people living with disabilities that are unable to make ends meet rests about 51%. So this particular project has helped us to understand the significant challenges that Louisiana people with disabilities face in being able to cover the basics.
Were there any other surprises in the research or any other data that you were looking for that confirmed some assumptions and some previous findings?
What we've learned is that housing, securing affordable housing, securing accessible housing, is a great challenge for people with disabilities. A big point is that the low wage earning averages, about 35% of people with disabilities are spending 35% or more on rent. Most of those individuals are not currently accessing high-speed internet. And with the pandemic and with the changes in the workforce, And the lack of access could really present some serious challenges for someone that lives with a disability.
So the lack of employment opportunities very much affects how they are able to live and how they're able to function just as a basic human being in contemporary society.
That's correct.
Let's burrow down to ALICE a little bit. I want to learn a little bit more about it. It's the asset limited, income constrained, and employed. What does it mean to live below that ALICE threshold? Is it possible that the ALICE threshold is a better benchmark than the poverty line?
Well, the ALICE threshold takes in account using research-based data. What does it take to live in Louisiana? We go further to understand what does it take to live in a specific parish. And so we factor in the cost of housing, childcare, food, transportation, healthcare, and technology. We average that based on facts. We come up with a budget and we find ALICE earning above the traditional federal poverty level, but below what it takes to cover these very basics. And just to share the numbers with you, in Louisiana, according to our ALICE report, one would need to earn approximately $24,252 to cover the basics. And we also would acknowledge that the cost for the basics for someone with disabilities are likely to be higher. For the sake of the calculation, we use averages. The federal poverty rate for an individual is right above $12,000. So the earner that earns between the federal poverty rate at $12,000, but below the $24,000 threshold, that's where you find ALICE. And that's where we find 35% of our Louisiana people with disabilities. That's where they're found statistically.
Now, your research also found that about 82% of the residents with disabilities live below the ALICE threshold do not receive supplemental security income or SSIs. Why is that?
A lot of it has to do with policy, which hasn't been updated for nearly four decades. A big reason why more than 348,000 residents with disabilities in Louisiana do not receive supplemental security income is that you must hold less than $2,000 in your bank account, $3,000 if you're married, to be eligible. And so what it points out is that there's a significant need that exists, and programs like the Supplemental Security Income Aid do not come close to filling the needs, especially those people that live with disabilities.
It seems like in general, there are some outdated laws and guidelines that define what it means to live in poverty, what it looks like to have a disability, and what the true cost of living is. As you just explained, what are some of the things that need updating? What do we need to account for that we currently are not?
Well, first, what we believe is that it's important to truly understand the challenges for people with disabilities and to ensure we're not undercounting the people with disabilities that are struggling to make ends meet. The federal poverty threshold is a measure that can inform us. We believe the ALICE data helps us to have a more complete understanding and a hyperlocal understanding for people with disabilities in our own communities and what it takes to survive. So we think that having the facts are very important. We also believe that we need to work together to combat the stigma and amplify the voices and needs of people with disabilities. I mean, to listen to some of their challenges, it's one thing to find an apartment. There's so many people out there that's seeking housing, trying to find an affordable place to be able to live, whether it be to buy and rent. People with disabilities have to take it one step further. They have to find an affordable place to live that's also accessible with the accommodations that they may need to be able to live and to be self-sufficient. And so it's easy to forget some of the additional challenges or barriers that people with disabilities have to clear in order to be successful. And I think it's important for us to be mindful of that, the need for housing, the need for healthcare access, the need for high-speed internet access, the need to be able to succeed in educational attainment so that more productive workforce engagement can take place for all of our citizens.
Let's pivot to something a little more optimistic. Chaos breeds opportunity. While the pandemic forced many of us to work remotely, I know for some people with disabilities, there was an upside because they were able to work from home. What do you think the pandemic taught us about accessibility? Are there lessons there when it comes to making work a little more accessible?
I think we definitely, the workplace innovated around how we can physically convene to do work. However, the reality is that during the pandemic, more people with disabilities actually experienced a job loss than those without disabilities. Approximately 29% of people with disabilities reported a job loss versus those without at 20%. So, as much of an advancement as we've made, being able to use technology to convene and perform work that reduces our physical need to be mobile all the time. If one doesn't have access to accommodations or to high-speed internet, it could further isolate those individuals as a result of the changes.
We've got to move away from more than half of Louisianans with disabilities living below the poverty line. What are the solutions? What are the goals here?
I think the goal is to lift up the information and lift up the facts and have all sectors, government, business, nonprofit, consider how they might be able to contribute to solutions. I know for United Ways, we use this data to inform how we help. We use this data to inform effective ways to fund programs to better meet needs in our communities, and we're going to do the same with this information. We also need to keep hearing directly from people with disabilities on how we can help them. What do they need the most? And ensure they're not left behind. With policy, like all of the public benefits that are available, we do need to consider how those policy changes affect them, not just people with disabilities, but just people in general that fall below the ALIS threshold. How are our decisions impacting their lives for the better? Is it helping or hurting? I think it's a constant evaluation.
Sarah, this has been informative in an alarming way. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Carl. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for your interest in ALIS and the challenges with people with disabilities in our state.
That was Sarah Berthelot, President and CEO of the Louisiana Association of United Ways. I'm Carl Lengel. You're listening to Louisiana Considered on WRKF and WWNO.
Ningekwa sheri wakechi kunkwela mam batweri kweshila nema bamana kunjoka kwani.
That is new music from Mel Malanga. It's Requiem de l'Amour. It's from the new Putumayo CD Afro Cubano. Once described by the New York Times as a last holdout in the CD music industry, Putumayo still tempts you at the checkout with its colorful artwork and inviting celebration of world music. Putumayo has held on for three decades. The New Orleans-based company has pushed into different media, always holding to that celebration of our differences and our similarities. Dan Storper built the company on music playlists he personally curated. He joins us now to talk about Putumayo. Dan, thanks so much for taking some time with us today. Let's go back to the beginning. How did you come up with this? What inspired this?
Well, you know, I actually was a Latin American studies major in college and traveled to Latin America to visit the countries I'd studied and fell in love with the crafts and started an import business and named it after a little village and town along the Putumayo River, which flows into the Amazon, called Sibundoy, a little village. And decided that I would start a little handicraft import business, which led to retail shops in New York and a wholesale business selling clothing and handicrafts from around the world, and kept doing it under the name Putumayo, and eventually lost interest and kind of found myself in Golden Gate Park walking through to an exhibit at a museum there and heard this incredible African band. And I just flipped over the music, went back to New York, and they were playing thrash metal music in the store. And I just said, this is not appropriate for an international import store, and decided to start looking around and finding music that I could play that would help create an ambiance and environment. And that led to putting together a couple of tapes that were sent to the stores, and people flipped, and one thing led to another. I knew a couple of people that involved in the music business and proposed a collaboration to do compilations. And that was, I think, 91 or 92, and the first two came out in 93.
How did you end up in New Orleans, ultimately?
Well, I had started in 93, I started coming down to Jazz Fest pretty much every other year. So I already had a connection to New Orleans, but I met a woman in New York who's from New Orleans, and we started going out and eventually got married. And then she got pregnant, and we said, you know, we really don't want to raise the kid in Manhattan, so we decided to get a little pied-à-terre in New Orleans. What began as a little place to get away to ultimately ended up being a house that we spent some time renovating and decided to move everything down there. So I was commuting. I tell people for about 10 years I was commuting on JetBlue because I couldn't get my staff to move down. Right. So I had the office in New York and, you know, kept going back and forth. But, you know, the music really was the core of what we were doing. And I had some great people, one of whom, Jacob Edgar, I like to bring up because he's one of the main music researchers. And so, you know, between what I could do in my travels and researching online and what he could do, together we were able to essentially craft a lot of these Putumayo compilations. But coming to New Orleans really started me on the road to producing many more American roots compilations like jazz and blues collections and New Orleans themed collections. So around 2000, I started doing more of those. Next April will be our 30th anniversary. So, wow.
Excellent. So it's obvious you love this job. The creative side has got to just be fascinating. And it sounds like even from the beginning, it was always about the creative side and about bringing forth the creative side of other people. The business side has got to be tough. The digital has eroded the CD market. Artists have any number of channels that they can self-promote on. A couple of years back, you and I talked, and you were very excited about creating experiences around the artists. So I guess coming out of that, I'm curious, how do you survive with all of those challenges? You just keep looking for new ways. How did the experiences work out for you? It's been 3.5 years.
Well, you know, we certainly have done a number of different things. You know, there was a fascinating article that ran in the New York Times about Putumayo being probably the last company in the music business to enter the digital market. And we finally did. And so, you know, that's been a big part of whatever we've been able to do to keep going, which is really offering a combination of digital compilations along with, you know, the keeping up with doing new CDs, and also making playlists and doing streaming of songs that we find. So, you know, with the idea that the world is such a vast ocean of music, it's really hard to kind of identify those songs which really have kind of universal appeal and create a flow with an album or a playlist that takes you on a journey. So Putumayo's been continuing to do that. But for about 3 years, we were also, when we spoke last time, doing putting together musical tours. We did two musical tours to Cuba, one to New Orleans. They were great. But when COVID hit, it became far too difficult to keep going. So we kind of put that aside. And then, you know, part of my interest in music has led me to do some things like continue to work on finding places where music is appealing. So I continue to travel around the country visiting retailers. And Putumayo is known for selling to gift stores and museum shops and bookstores and children's stores. So I think that's been able to keep us going. And surprisingly, with adding album download cards to our CDs, it's actually kept the CDs going for us. And there's a weird statistic that I was a bit shocked to hear, that somehow CD sales went up last year 47% in the U.S., which, you know, isn't quite the number you'd expect. But I think there is this idea with the liner notes and putting together a package that takes you on a musical journey. You know, Putumayo's trying to find a way to kind of continue that going. You can't get the same thing quite with the liner notes and the information on a digital experience, although we do offer the liner notes if you do download an album. But we're also recreating some of our old albums through playlists. So, for instance, we have a couple of New Orleans playlists, even though we've discontinued a couple of the older Louisiana albums.
Tell us a little bit more, too. It's not just about the music. Children's books have become a very important part of Putumayo. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always been a fan of folk art and illustration and have been collecting it for many years. And as I travel around the world, I'd come across these lovely children's books that would obviously, in many cases, be in different languages. I got to know some of the children's publishers through that. And I thought one day, you know, I think a lot of the retailers that sell our CDs might appreciate some of these lovely children's books that I was finding in my travels. And so I began about 4.5 years ago. We actually created our own kind of cultural coloring books. We started doing that and tried to create original books, but it was such a hassle. I said, you know, let's stick to the ones that are out there that are doing, that are lovely, enchanting, and take kids on these adventures. And so we started distributing, I think, 3 or 4 books in the beginning about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's grown to now offering 30 children's books from 4 different publishers. And it's one of the things I like doing, you know, because, you know, when you work with a children's book company, you're kind of looking at things a little bit differently than the musical perspective. And you get to visit. I was just at the Louisiana Children's Museum, which you know does sell quite a few of our children's books. You get to visit these, you know, places that like ones that I used to have as retail stores. You know, I mean, in the early days of Putumayo, I used to love spending time in my stores talking to customers and being in that retail environment. I get to go back and do that now with both the music and the children's books.
What's in the future for Putumayo?
Well, you know, in addition to the children's books and the digital compilations that we're working on, we started doing actually digital-only EPs, 5-song collections that you can find normal places like iTunes and Apple Music, and you can find them on Putumayo's website and at Spotify, et cetera. But we're working on a couple of our own adult books, actually. I've decided to start a little book publishing company, so we're doing one kind of heroes and inspirational quotes for next year, and a travel book that is being worked on with a writer who's a friend of mine who writes for National Geographic and New York Times. So we're doing that. I'm actually personally working on a book about the 1960s and politics and culture, and from a New Orleans perspective particularly. And so it's, you know, there's always a way to kind of evolve one's efforts to kind of contain and continue to do things that you enjoy doing and find enough of an outlet out there. And I think that's the thing that's been great. We still sell a lot of CDs. Now that we've added the download cards, it's helped. And I think, you know, the combination just keeps me going. And I love to travel. I love to, you know, work with retailers. I love to work with songs and artists and books. So, you know, it keeps me going.
Inspirational, Dan. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Carl. Pleasure to be here.
Dan Storper of Putumayo Records. Coming up in October, Putumayo continues its celebration of our multicultural world with the release of Linda Ronstadt's musical journey, Feels Like Home, Songs from the Sonoran Highlands. It includes contributions from Ry Cooter, Emmy Lou Harris, Dolly Parton, and the band Los Cinzontles. I'm Carl Engel, and that's today's Louisiana Considered on WRKF and WWNO. Thanks to our guests, Sarah Berthelot and Dan Storper. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our digital editor is Caitlin Dumholtz. Engineers Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at 12 noon and 7:30 in the evening. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. Major support for Louisiana Considered is provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience with additional support from Southern Strategy Group.